A few years ago, I went out to Oakland with a colleague for anti-racism training. It was a training sponsored by the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond, which is just an awesome name of an anti-racism training organization. And it was a mixed group training, a variety of racial ethnic backgrounds rather than a homogenous training. And so as a part of that, at one point, the facilitators asked all the Black and brown people to listen to a white-only conversation about how we benefit from white supremacy. And at another point, they had the white people listen to a Black and brown-only conversation about how they internalize inferiority from white supremacy. It was a scene, like I've never been to a big, it was like 70 people. I've never been to a training like that. People shouted at each other. People cried. People walked out, unable to cope with it. And it was a space of learning for me. And I think a couple key things I walked away with were how deeply white I am, like shaped by whiteness, how I can't in any way avoid the social conditioning that has surrounded me since my first breath. And I saw it in ways I didn't anticipate in that training. And another key takeaway from one of the trainers who's an educator committed to equalizing the percentage of teachers of color with the number of students of color, really beautiful person. She just gave this really simple rubric, which I was really stuck with me. She said, do your self work first, and then do work with your people. And then maybe you'll be prepared to respectfully do work across racial ethnic divides. Just such realism in that. And I've really pondered that and tried to practice that. One day during the conference, since it was in Oakland, I walked down to Bethlehem Lutheran in West Oakland, which is where I did my year-long pastoral internship when I was in seminary. And it wasn't my first experience in a Black church, but it was certainly the deepest I'd been invited into the lives of African Americans at that point in my life. And over the course of the year, the stories I heard changed me. They changed my life. I got charged with building and developing the youth group. And there's probably like 15 kids in the youth group. And when we started the year together, one of the first things they did was give me hip hop albums so I could get to know them. They gave me Fear of a Black Planet, Public Enemy, and the Fugees, The Score. Both like totally classic, great albums. And interestingly, both albums have songs about police brutality. I think every decade of the history of hip hop from the 70s to the present has songs about police brutality. It's just this total constant. But for me, it was a novelty. I was like, oh, so the dividing line between us is my assumption of protection by the police and your assumption of danger from the police. After we've gotten to know each other, one of the young adult advisors from the youth group, whose name was Calvin, told me a story that showed me like profoundly how true this was, that we lived in different worlds and saw the world in different ways, because it turns out he had gone to my hometown, Bozeman, Montana, as a college student. And I knew that the only Black people in my hometown were scholarship athletes for the university, either football or basketball. And Calvin had gotten a full ride to play basketball. So he spent 4 years in this town I had loved, that I grew up in thinking was, you know, liberal college town, all kinds of people, you know, like me, oriented to outdoors sports, to hiking and fishing in the summer, and cross country and downhill skiing in the winter. And like Calvin was a gentle giant, like the kindest kind of person. Like when he walked through the congregation, he had a kind of a Jake, right? He had a kind word for everybody. And he didn't have a kind word for my hometown. He said it was too hot in the summer and too cold in the winter, as a person from the Bay Area would. And he said it was too racist every day of the year. Every kind of stereotype you could imagine that happens to African-American, especially African-American men, happened to him. Being called the N-word, being asked where he was from, like, you know, the assumption being he certainly couldn't be from Bozeman. Being followed around in stores, not served or served slowly at restaurants, people crossing the street to avoid him, on and on, just constant. And he knew it wasn't about him. He had such a powerful upbringing with his mom, Lena May, who was a total matriarch at church, and the whole Bethlehem Lutheran family just surrounded him from his childhood and said, "You're a blessed child of God, you're beautiful." And he knew that about himself. But this distinction between the two of us just is so profound. And I saw it then. And I started reading Ibram Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, and I'll say more about that in a minute. But he has, at the beginning of his book, this, I think, great encapsulation of this dynamic between Calvin and myself and what our society does to us. Kendi writes, racist ideas make people of color think less of themselves, which makes them more vulnerable to racist ideas. And racist ideas make white people think more of themselves, which further attracts them to racist ideas. It's very seductive and in damaging ways in both directions. So this sickness of racism, of white supremacy, that is so at stake in this moment in our country, I think is just the sort of sickness that Jesus made it his mission to heal, that he sent his disciples out to heal as part of his good news movement, that heaven had come near, that things had been made whole and well, that shalom had been established. I see this text from Matthew that we have today as Jesus deepened the work. He was clear he couldn't get to everyone himself, so he sent his disciples with instructions to carry the movement far and wide. And he gives lots of instructions. There's a lot in this text. It's a long text, but I want to focus in on the place where I think his motivation for his actions becomes clear. We know that disease and sickness in biblical times had a social meaning and a social cost, being ostracized, being seen as lesser or disposable. And Jesus, Matthew tells us, went all over preaching the good news of freedom and dignity and healing to all these ostracized, separated, oppressed people, overturning that reality for them. And people heard about him and they came in droves. And so verse 36, I think, if you pulled up the text, you can check that verse, I'll read it to you. I think it's crucial to everything that follows in this story. And really, I think it's crucial to understanding Jesus at all. The verse is, when he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. The first thing about that sentence I want to point to is the word compassion, which Matthew uses multiple times to talk about how Jesus responds, like Jesus's like bodily response to people who are suffering. It comes from, it's obviously a Greek word, and it's splagnizomai. It comes from splankna, which is the guts, like the inward parts. And it was thought to be where sort of concern or pity or a sense of love for others came from. And so I just think of, like, you know, when people say, like, I felt all torn up about it, or I felt sick to my stomach about it. Like, it's this visceral feeling that word compassion entails. And knowing that background gives it a kind of heft that you don't get necessarily just from the translation compassion. So he's really very much connected to and responding to how people are suffering. And then the second part of the sentence, referring to people as harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd, is if you don't have the sort of the biblical resonance for that, it can seem sort of nice and pastoral, like, oh, sheep are cute and all that. But he's literally referencing the prophet Ezekiel, and his hearers would have had that prophetic background, that that phrase was a phrase for critiquing the leadership of the nation and expressing how the oppressive structure was hurting ordinary people. So I want to just read you just a brief chunk of Ezekiel chapter 34, which just, you can hear the echoes exactly of Jesus' language here in this passage from Ezekiel, but it gives you the sensibility that people would have heard when they heard Jesus speak this kind of language. The word of the Lord came to me. Ezekiel, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Woe to you, shepherds of Israel, who only take care of yourselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? You eat the curds, clothe yourself with wool, slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock. You have not strengthened the weak or healed the sick or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. You have ruled them harshly and brutally. So they were scattered because there was no shepherd, and when they were scattered, they became food for all the wild animals. My sheep wandered all over the mountains on every high hill. They were scattered over the whole earth, and no one searched or looked for them. Therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, because my flocks lack a shepherd, and so has been plundered and become food for all the wild animals, because my shepherds did not search for my flock, but cared for themselves rather than my flock, therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. I am against the shepherds and will hold them accountable for my flock. I will remove them from tending the flock, so the shepherds will no longer feed themselves. I will rescue my flock from their mouths, and it will no longer be food for them. It's all in metaphor, but the words jump out that give this kind of socio-political picture. Woe to you, shepherds of Israel, who only take care of yourselves. You ruled them harshly and brutally, plundered. I am against the shepherd and will hold them accountable. I mean, is it any wonder that later on in this passage, Jesus warns his disciples, I'm sending you out as sheep among the wolves. You will be dragged before governors and kings because of me. It's almost like he's sending them out to protest in the street, knowing that they're going to be countered with deadly force, with aggressive force. And he's preparing them. It's like an organizing training. And he's preparing them almost like as nonviolent protesters to anticipate the harshness with which they're going to be received. And, you know, Jesus sends us all. We're all, Matthew's key thing is discipleship. And he wants us to hear with the disciples Jesus sending us. And I shared on Facebook and in our weekly update all the different ways that we're sent, all the different ways our gifts and talents play out as we're sent. We don't all have the same role. And when we think of ourselves in terms of racial, ethnic identity, we have different work to do in this moment. Depending on whether we're white or black or brown, we have different work to do to find liberation. But I think it's important to claim that liberation for those who are oppressed actually entails liberation for us all. So just to wrap up, I've been really thinking about not what do we say, but what do we do? And how do we do that together? And I'm interested in reading some books together as a congregation over the next months. And one of them is by Austin Channing Brown, who wrote, I'm Still Here, Black Dignity in a World Made for Whiteness. And she's been doing a anti-racist homework assignment thing on her blog, which I think is lovely. And when we get that kind of homework, I think it's the kind of homework that lets us answer Jesus' call to heal and make whole our broken bodies and our broken systems that consider some of us disposable. The first thing that she says is our homework is to trouble the narrative. Don't accept simplistic analyses. She says, I think, in a lovely turn of phrase, in other words, if you think looting is a problem, no. She says, if Jesus held a one-man riot over capitalism in the temple, don't think he'd be calm about George Floyd. Trouble the narrative about Jesus as a rabble-rouser. Then she says, understand the case for reparations. In other words, if you think looting is a problem, learn the deeper history of America looting land and labor to become the richest nation in the world. And then her third in her list of the beginning homework assignment is practice undermining whiteness. In other words, if you think whiteness is given or natural, learn the systemic construction of whiteness and racial hierarchy as foundational to our nation's history so that you can act to undermine it. Those are examples of things to do. And I think I want as a congregation for us to both think together about this moment and how we hold each other, but also what we do together. And that will take many forms, but we need help in thinking about that as we go. And I mentioned Ibram Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, earlier, and I want to read that in July together as a congregation and just reflect together. What does he begin to help us to see that we should do? So Jesus, I hear sending us to be prophetic healing laborers. And he's promised to be with us always in this work. It's work that's inspired by a gift. And in the midst of this work, that gift is the experience of a foretaste of heaven come near, a foretaste of the feast of liberation to come. It's a foretaste we taste in our community together. And it's a foretaste at moments in the midst of a protest, in the midst of an embrace with a loved one. It's an experience of what it would like to be truly human and for everyone to have space to be truly human. The glory of God, in the words of the early church theologian Irenaeus, is a living human being. And I love that quote. It's in a sense the goal of it all. For us to be able to be living human beings. And I think in this moment, it's important to say the glory of God is a living Black human being. Because insofar as that's true, it's true about all of us.